This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
The contributions to the patient engagement movement made by cancer survivor Dave DeBronkart have been impactful and inspiring. Dave is the author of Let Patients Help, a patient engagement handbook, which has been translated into, I believe, 9 different languages. And on top of all this, Dave delivered the keynote address at DIA Europe 2019 in Vienna in February. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of DIA Global Forum. Dave DeBronkart joins me today to share his experiences, passion, and ideas on patient engagement in healthcare. Dave, thank you for being with us today and welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm really, truly passionate about this.
Why do you refer to yourself as e-patient Dave? What does e-patient mean?
E-patient is a term that was coined in the 1990s by a doctor named Tom Ferguson, who was a real visionary. And I know the word visionary gets tossed around a lot. I worked in business in innovation through most of my career. I worked in high tech, specifically in the graphic arts. So I've seen innovation, and I've also seen a lot of empty promotional language that really came down to nothing. To me, a visionary is someone who talks about the future and then it comes true. And Tom Ferguson was that way. He saw, even earlier in the 1980s, that the vast majority of what people do for health and care in their families is take care of themselves at home. So he published a magazine and a book called Medical Self-Care. He knew that when real trouble hits, like the stage 4 kidney cancer that I had, a factor limiting how much we could do was our access to information. And when the web came along in 1994, he saw that that changed what's possible. It didn't make us physicians or scientists or anything, but it changed what's possible. And he coined this term e-patient to describe patients who are empowered, engaged, equipped, enabled. It's the exact opposite of a patient who sits back and says, I don't know, you're the scientist, you tell me. And when I learned about this, it turns out that during my cancer adventure in 2007, the way I acted was to be an e-patient, empowered and engaged, although I didn't know the term yet. And then when I discovered it a year later, I changed the name of my blog from Patient Dave to e-patient Dave, just to publicize the concept in social media. I didn't become famous until 2 years after that, when the name went viral.
In this day and age of email, the term e-patient conjures images of electronic patient, but obviously you've explained that that's not what the e means. Having said that, you've also mentioned social media, which of course are electronic means of communicating and interacting. So does the E in that context possibly also suggest the electronic venues by which empowered and engaged patients are empowered and engaged?
Well, yes. I'm glad you mentioned that, because originally back in the 90s, that's exactly the analogy that Ferguson used. E-patient is to patient as email is to mail.
Okay, so that clears it up. You co-founded the Society for Participatory Medicine. Let's talk about what is the concept of participatory medicine and whether it's different from what we currently call patient engagement, another very popular term that's been used these days in constructive ways. What is participatory medicine?
Patient engagement is a subset of participatory medicine, and there's real peril when culture is changing. I'm glad you're asking about this, because terminology is decisive. If we're not clear on definitions, then we will not have a clear paradigm from which we can operate. Participatory medicine is about partnership between the patient and the clinical or scientific expert. It's precisely analogous to participatory democracy, in the sense that rather than having one class of informed, powerful people who look at a situation and come up with policies and principles and mandate them on the population, which knows nothing. That's one way of governing, is for a group of people who know what should be done to tell everyone else what they're going to do. That's not participatory. In participatory democracy, the citizens say, well, excuse me, I have an opinion about this. And that's exactly the way it is with participatory medicine. As a marketing guy throughout my whole career, I like to come up with slogans. And one of my favorite slogans is patient is not a third person word. A lot of people in healthcare talk about patients as if it's those people walking past on the street out there. But I point out every one of us sooner or later comes to understand what it means. Now, I want to be careful here because some people say, well, we don't need to invite patients into our conversations because we will all be a patient someday. It turns out that in principle, that may be fine, but in practice, it fails. Time after time, what we find is that even scientists and physicians, when they become the person who's in an ICU bed, they say, oh, it looks different from here. Because then the urgency of, are we going to succeed now here in this case, becomes apparent. And when you want to speak up and discuss your preferences, your wishes, your desires, or how it's going, you want to be heard. And this brings us back to the question of patient engagement, the definition. For me, engagement is where there is two-way conversation. Too often, I hear people with the best of intentions, especially in pharmaceuticals, thinking about patient engagement as making the patient do what you want, making the patient take their medicine and buy more. And that's a valid concern because the whole plan won't work if the patient doesn't take their medicine. But to me, that's a very incomplete subset. Patient engagement is about a dialogue, which is part of participatory medicine.
Let me follow up on that. You've been advocating for participatory medicine for several years, of course, and your passion does come through. You've gone around the country, perhaps around the world, with these concepts. How has the medical profession reacted to this? For example, it could be argued that medical professionals are medically trained and many, perhaps most patients are not. Is there a gap between patients and doctors that is hard to fill because patients are not as medically qualified and trained as doctors are? So how are doctors reacting to your concept of participatory medicine? Are they on board? Are they pushing back? What are they saying?
Well, it varies. It varies in different cultures. It varies within different countries. And the underlying issue here, and I will say that compared to 10 years ago, physicians' minds have largely opened up. We still have the problem that some physicians were explicitly taught that their value as a human is to know things that patients don't know. And I have had conversations. I've done more than 600 events in 19 countries and had lots of conversations before and after my speeches where I would look a doctor in the eye. We'd be really directly connecting. And in some cases, I've seen them searching their own souls. One doctor said to me, I was trained that my value to society is that I know these difficult things that patients don't, which may save their lives. If a patient has seen an article in a journal that I haven't seen, then what good am I? And it's a brilliant question because it raises the question, what is the ensemble of traits, the suite of skills, aptitudes, and so on that goes into being a physician? Now, in the past, 100 years ago and before, there's no question that the only way to know anything useful was to have the medical training and be part of that conversational community, talking to other colleagues. But that is no longer true. And yet, having access to articles, as I do, does not mean that I have the clinical experience or the technical training to fully understand them. See, what's happening here is this whole gestalt of skills and attributes that used to mean doctor is getting broken up into particles now, and some of them are available outside of that gestalt. We still need the entire gestalt. But in fact, if you look at it correctly, it actually can be a blessing because until the era of e-patients empowered by the internet, the physician carried all of the burden of knowing all of the treatment options. And as the flood of literature has expanded continuously, more than 300,000 articles, no, it's more than that, like 800,000 articles were published last year, for patients to be able to share some of the work so that we can collaborate can be seen as a blessing. In particular,
if we unpack that a little bit, Dave, sorry to interrupt, that suggests that doctors need to be willing to admit that they cannot keep up with the entirety of the literature, particularly perhaps internists, where their field is so vast that they couldn't possibly keep up with all developments in neurology, in gastroenterology, right, in diabetes, cardiovascular, etc. So they might actually appreciate patients coming in with literature and papers that this particular doctor may not have seen. Have you seen that change of attitude, that acceptance?
To some extent. Now, I want to be clear. One of the things that we need to make this culture change a practical reality is for us to evolve our entire concept of what is the nature of the interaction between a patient, somebody with a need, and the system in general. The traditional view has been, I walk into the doctor's office and I get treated after a conversation. If we add to that the discovery of 40 relevant journal articles, which get introduced when I walk in that door, that's just not practical. So my vision is one where the exchange of information is more of a continuous process and is not solely dependent on the visit or even the physician. My vision includes having tiers of conversation. As one trivial example, in my own case, when I found information online, I would say to my oncologist, I found this online, what do you think? In our case, back in 2007, we were able to do that. Today, some medical practices, some insurance companies, some health systems have, for instance, a nurse helpline where I can ring up or go into an online chat box and talk with somebody who knows more than I do, even though they're not an oncologist. And I can send them the URL and say, what do you think? And they can say good or bad. The whole purpose, the context for this entire initiative is not to have physicians feel threatened, but to help healthcare achieve its potential with the patient contributing what they're able to.
To me, it seems that this would require a couple of things. One is an attitude of respect from the patient towards the doctor in deference to medical training and to a greater body of knowledge. So the patient, I expect, would need to be respectful of the doctor, but equally the doctor would have to be sincerely respectful of the patient and not patronizing the patient by suggesting perhaps I'm a doctor and you're not. Does that resonate with your approach and philosophy?
Well, of course, and that's in collaboration, in participatory discussions, that's what you would expect. This fits perfectly with the whole idea of coaching and mentoring. If I am a football coach, or if I'm a math coach, or if I'm a tutor, what I want to do is develop the competence. If I'm mentoring someone, whether it's in sports or some school subject or something, my goal is to develop the competence of the person I'm mentoring. And this is precisely the type of relationship that I have with my clinicians, my doctors, nurses, and so on, where their role is to improve my ability to support me in climbing the ladder of knowing more. I have no intention of ever knowing as much or with as much sophistication as them.
Let's turn to the business side of things. I'm reminded that the title of your keynote address at DIA Europe in 2019 was Patient Experience Empowerment Engagement, a Business Leader's View. So patients certainly think that patient engagement is good for patients, I expect, but do business leaders think that patient engagement is also good for business?
Well, yes and no on the whole subject. I want to be clear. Patients like me certainly think that patient engagement is good, and I'd say not just for patients, but for achieving the mission of care. As I said, my whole purpose here is to help healthcare achieve its potential. But there are certainly patients who don't want to be engaged at all, and I mean that in at least two different ways. First of all, there are some patients who really believe that the doctor knows best, or they may just be overwhelmed by the complexity of medical information, and they may really, really want the doctor to make the decision. My opinion is that in those cases, good care means listening to that and making the decisions when necessary. Another aspect of patient engagement is the part where the patient follows the plan, where the patient does what's recommended. And we all know there are people in the world who don't want to eat better. They don't care.
Right.
They don't even care whether they are healthy.
They don't exercise. They don't control their eating. They don't modify their lifestyles. Is that what you're saying?
That can be part of it. I'm very careful, though, because all of those things are strongly affected by the social determinants of health. You know, somebody who lives in what we call a food desert, where there is no healthy food available to buy in any local grocery stores. It's not just that it's unfair to blame people for all the circumstances they live in. It's just plain not effective as a policy or an intervention, because blaming them, even if they decide to try to do better, I have two grocery stores within walking distance of me that have good quality food. And for somebody who doesn't, that's going to be a problem. But separate from that, there are people who just, even if they lived right upstairs in an apartment building from an organic grocery store, there are some people who just don't care. And those patients aren't going to care about being engaged. So the reason I'm going into this is we are talking about a social change, every bit as profound as the women's movement, when women started saying, excuse me, but I have an opinion, I have things that I want. The resulting changes in behavior, it's funny, a few years ago, I used to say, took perhaps a century, but these days things have gone backwards so much in issues of respect for women in the world that sometimes I have to say, culture change takes a long time, maybe forever. And I have used that analogy of the women's movement. When I was in college, long ago, the women's movement was going through Boston. And if you went to a dance, it used to be the boy leads and the girl follows. Well, girls were starting to say, thank you, I don't need you leading me. I'll do it my own way. And we all needed to learn different dance steps. And along the way, we stepped on each other's feet.
So with respect to participatory medicine, are we approaching a tipping point where the medical profession is ready for this and accepting it and even embracing it? Or are we still a long way from that?
I have come to think of social change over the entire population of humanity as like being a gigantic amoeba. If you can imagine yourself as a little person at the edge of a gigantic amoeba, you're pulling at one end of it. And it takes an enormous amount of work to get the leading edge to change. And you think, finally, it changed. And then you look around and realize that the vast majority of it hasn't moved at all yet.
Well, an interesting analogy. So where are we? Are we moving the amoeba at all?
So two things. First of all, in the leading edge of the social conversation about this, we certainly have acceptance that the premise of patient engagement, empowerment, patient contribution to the conduct of care is valid. It is not ludicrous, even though, you know, I was, after one of my early speeches, a doctor walked right up to me and said, this is all crap. You know, and another doctor a few years later after I spoke, he was on the next panel, and he looked at me from the audience and said, if you want to know who the best surgeon is, I'll tell you. Don't get that from some blog. So the change is happening, but there's an important factor here. In my keynote in Vienna, I quoted Max Planck, the physicist who 100 years ago got the Nobel Prize in physics. He said at the end of his career, a new scientific truth does not win acceptance by convincing its opponents and making them see the light. It wins acceptance because its opponents eventually die. And a new generation comes up that is familiar with the new truth. In his case, it was quantum mechanics. 2009 is when I found myself on the front page of the newspaper and began this advocacy. That was 10 years ago. in the 10 years since then, the oldest 10 years of the physician population has retired or aged out and has been replaced with another generation who are entirely digital natives. They know themselves two important things. It's possible to find valid information by yourself on the internet, but you have to be careful because there's a lot of crap on the internet too. So the social change is rolling through. It's more accepted than it was, but we have much work remaining to be done. But that's why I'm so happy to do a podcast like this, because the work of culture change takes place in conversations like this.
Your most recent comments in the last several minutes raised the age question, and that is participatory medicine going to be embraced more readily by younger doctors than by older doctors who've been practicing for 40, 50, maybe 60 years, whereas the newer generation of doctors may be more open to this new approach to patients? Is that a fair notion?
All I can speak about is my personal observation, and as a general rule, yes, in the same way that younger people in general are more likely to be using apps and smartphones than elders. But be careful, I'm almost 70 years old, and I don't look or act like anybody thinks 70 years old is supposed to be. Old is older than it used to be. I say this because commonly people think that once you reach, say, 65, retirement age in the U.S., that you are one of these people who doesn't know how to use the internet or something like that. And you can cause yourself a lot of mental errors, which in business is not a good thing. We are in a world, in an era, where reality is changing a lot faster than people's common beliefs are. That's why it's good to listen to podcasts like this, to go to events like that DIA conference where I spoke. You've got to stay current or you will become obsolete in your thinking, and your competitors who are staying current will be able to beat you because the rules have changed.
Our time is almost up, but I do want to ask you about another important topic, and that relates to clinical research. Some patients, many patients, participate in clinical research. And the question I would like to ask you is, should patients be paid for participating in clinical research? And if so, by whom and how much?
It's a very complicated question. I have an opinion on the general subject of clinical research that there's a deeper issue, which is why we are involving patients and how we're involving patients in the first place. I know that recruitment has become a problem partly because patients don't see a direct connection between participating in any value for themselves. But I think that we're going to see an era where we have more patient-defined objectives, especially in communities like, for instance, Parkinson's, where patients are tired of participating in studies that are not aligned with their own values. Now, if you have a clinical trial where the objective, the primary endpoint, is defined by patients, you're going to find a lot more volunteers, people who are happy to do that, as opposed to somebody who's being asked to step back from using the current standard of care and collaborate out of their, participate out of the goodness of their heart. I am not qualified, I think, to talk about by whom they'd be paid and how much, because there are so many questions that go into what's the value proposition in the first place.
Right. I appreciate that. I respect it. Some of your comments are aligned with the current trend towards engaging patients in the design of clinical trials in order to make those trials more relevant to the needs and requirements of patients. Again, engaging patients in the design of research in which they will participate is certainly an evolving trend at this time. Well, Dave, that's all the time we have today. I really appreciate your insight, your advocacy, your support, and your participation today. Thank you very much.
I am very happy to be able to contribute, and particularly to reach this audience. I am very much in favor of doing everything we all can together to help science better achieve its potential in the service of healthcare.
Thank you. For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.